I'm Pete McCarthy. You're listening to the Baseball and Barbecue Podcast.
From the studios of Baseball and BBQ on Long Island, New York, this is episode number 216. Happy anniversary, Len, of Baseball and BBQ. I'm Jeff the Oku Cohen, and that's Leonard Hollywood Aberman. And yes, this is our sixth anniversary show. Leonard.
Happy anniversary. Happy anniversary.
Okay, thank you very much.
My gift to you will be, I won't continue singing that, but Jeff.
That's a gift to everybody listening, Len. Thank you very much.
You know, Jeff, people like your rants and they tolerate my singing. So 6 years, Jeff, does it seem like 6 years?
No, it doesn't. It went by really fast.
It did. It seriously. You know, we just did episode 200. Now we're celebrating 6 years. It's a special episode because it's 6 years. And we've got two great guests. Why don't we start off telling everybody who we have? Jeff, first guest is going to be?
He is the voice of many, many games. You've heard him all. You've heard him all over. He is Kenny Albert. He does baseball, football, basketball, hockey, Olympics, volleyball, golf. You name it, he's done it. Kenny Albert.
He's written a book. It's called A Mike for All Seasons. And that couldn't be truer than that is so true. Kenny Albert. And he's from a long line of announcers, right?
It's all yes. you know the names. Yep, the Albert family, announcers.
So we've got Kenny Albert. And then for our barbecue guests, we have Paul Holden. Paul Holden is from Willingham's. Willingham's Barbecue, was started by John Willingham, Barbecue Hall of Famer. And Paul Holden is continuing that tradition. What a spectacular interview. So before we get to any of that and our six-year anniversary, I'm just going to tell everybody that Bet Online remains your top spot for all your live betting action and contests. NFL, college football, UFC, and NHL are all in full swing. Bet Online is your number one source for wagering news, odds, trends, and predictions with both desktop and mobile access at any time. Head to the Bet Online today and use our promo code BLEAV. You know how to spell it. It's B L E A V, and you will get your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet Online. It is where the game starts. Jeff, 6 years. Oh, wow. That's all I'm going to say. 6 years.
What else is there to say?
Well, there is one thing to say. There was a big announcement this week, ended a lot of speculation. It is that Shohei Ohtani, finally, we know where he's going. We know what he's getting. $70 million a year for 10 years to the Dodgers. As they say, what a bargain.
Len, as a Dodger, Shohei Ohtani will be making $20 million from 2024 to 2033. And then only $680 million from 2034 to 2043. There's some special accounting there.
Creative
accounting. That's accounting. The way to go. And Dodgers now, they really pulled a rabbit out of the hat. and they can now sign Yamamoto. Now, listen, we are recording this. It's a Monday, the 11th. It's coming out on the 16th. Things could happen in between. I'm just saying, right, that is a hell of a bargain. And, you know, maybe not $68 million 10 years from now. But, you know, $700 million, it's not going to go as far in 10, 20 years, is it?
No, won't go at all. I hope that he'll be able to stretch a buck and
Well, you know, he can't afford. Obviously, if he's getting $2 million in 2024, he's going to make $50 million in endorsements. So nobody's throwing a pity party for him. That's for sure. No one's throwing a fundraiser. But let me just tell you that the Dodgers, and ranked for expected salary in 2024, as of right now, Betts, Freeman, Taylor, Muncie, Haywood, Smith, Buehler, Kelly, Rojas, Yarbrough, Barnes, Gosselin, Phillips, Gatterall, Bergeson, May, then Ohtani. That doesn't seem right. It just doesn't seem right.
No, there's, I don't know. Well, then how come other teams couldn't get him, you know?
I tell you what, now that precedent's been set, the Cohen, the Steinbrenner of the world, you know they're going to take, oh, wait a second. Now, there's only one thing that can happen. Look, I read today that can they void this contract? And according to Jeff Passan, I'm going to read this. For anyone wondering if MLB will challenge or cancel Ohtani's contract, the answer is unequivocally no. There is a specific article in the collective bargaining agreement that addresses this, and it's very clear. Deferred money is limitless, even 680 of 700 million. Now, I think it's going to be negotiated in the next collective bargaining agreement. They're going to try to stop that from happening. But the only thing that the commissioner can do, if he invokes this, and I doubt it will happen, the best interest of baseball clause. Can he invoke that? I guess he can. Will he do it? No. Rob Manfred would never do that. And I don't know if this is good for baseball or not. I really don't. What do you think?
It's you're going to have a lot of, you know how the Mets every year and it seems to be the big joke around the league, even though other teams have players that are getting the money, is, you know, Bobby Bonilla Day, right? That's the big joke. I mean, even when we went to Kansas City, we went for a game. It was the Royals against the Cardinals. There were no Mets involved. No Mets. Yep. And yet there was somebody there. There was a fan. And on the back of his jacket, he was wearing a jacket. What did it say on it? Do you remember?
Bonilla, and it had a big dollar sign on the back. Right. I remember, yeah.
We're in Kansas City. It wasn't. How is that even? But so Bobby Bonilla Day. So now, what are you going to have? Ohtani's going to be long retired, and then every year. Well, I don't think on one particular day they're going to give him, you know, $68 million or whatever. It'll be spread out, but every day is going to be Ohtani Day.
Can we retire Bobby Bonilla Day now? Could we stop that joke? I mean, really. Yeah. Stop that now.
It's
now near, normal.
There's nothing there. Bobby Bonilla Day is like an at bat for Ohtani.
Yeah.
When you figure out what he'll make per at bat or per start, you know, pitch or who knows. Anyway, you know what? You got to give credit to whoever came up with the deal. It works for Ohtani because he's still making tons and tons and tons of money. It works for the Dodgers because they'll be able to do however they do their books and their accounting and the creativity and all. It works. So somebody is quite brilliant.
Yep, absolutely.
I mean, Jeff, you're an accountant. How come you didn't come up with that deal?
Yeah, I'm an accountant. Obviously not a smart accountant, but I'm an accountant.
Don't say that. It's our 6-year anniversary. Look,
I don't have any loopholes named after me. I tell you that.
Oh, wow. Wow. Anyway, we should get right to our guest, and that is Kenny Albert. And if people from all over the place. I mean, in New York, of course, Marv Albert is extremely well known. He was the voice of the Knicks for years and years, voice of the Rangers. And his son is Kenny Albert. And he has made a career for himself, an incredible career. And now he's written this book. Everybody, I hope you enjoy it as much as we did. This is Kenny Albert.
Comes to legendary broadcasters, we know the names: Scully, Buck, Barber, Allen, and Albert. If you're a fan of any sport, then you have heard our guest's voice, be it on the radio or television. He's been a sportscaster for a quarter of a century, broadcasting every major and minor sport you can think of. He has called more than 3,000 games, among them Super Bowls, NBA, NHL, NBA, MLB postseason games, All-Star games in several sports, college basketball, football, WNBA, Olympics, boxing, horse racing, and even track and field. His color analyst has been just as legendary: Troy Aikman, Wayne Gretzky, Walt Clyde Frazier, and a former guest of ours, Jim Cott, to name a few. Baseball and BBQ is humbled to have with us the great Kenny Albert. Welcome, Kenny.
Welcome.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate the introduction.
My first question to you is that your childhood was spent on Long Island, yet your favorite team was located 3,113 miles away in Western Canada in the Vancouver Canucks. How does that happen?
That's a great question. I was a Canucks fan as a youngster, starting at about 5 years of age in the early 1970s. I'm not sure if it was just the name that stood out to me, the Vancouver Canucks. The jerseys at the time were not yet the crazy red, yellow, and black. They had the green and blue with the rink and the stick logo that they've actually gone back to in recent years. So not sure exactly how the fandom came about, but I was a passionate Canucks fan. I kept scrapbooks. I would cut the box scores out of Newsday, usually 2 days later because they played on the West Coast. And it was always a thrill to see the Canucks when they played in the New York area.
Yes. Kenny, the book is fantastic. It's called A Mic for All Seasons: My Three Decades Announcing the NFL, NHL, NBA, MLB, and Olympics. Even the beginning, when you have, you know, we deal with a lot of authors. You know, they'll have some blurbs in the beginning from some people who are touting the book. You have basically a book of blurbs. I mean, it's unbelievable. You even have Constantine Morales from American Idol fame and also Broadway. It's like a who's who.
Well, first of all, I was so honored to have Wayne Gretzky and Walt Clyde Frazier, two broadcast partners, participate writing the forwards. You know, that's surreal whenever I look at the cover and see their names. And then many of my colleagues and peers took part in that blurb section. And it's kind of like reading a who's who. You know, this is your life, so to speak. So,
right.
thrilled that they all participated, and glad to hear that you guys enjoyed the book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And let's start at the beginning. You actually are a miracle that you're here, because, you know, we're all around the same age. And when you were born prematurely. And at that time, they didn't have all the technology they do now. You were a fighter from birth, because you were born, what, 3 months premature?
3 months premature. I was 1 pound, 15 ounces when I was born. I wound up going down to 1 pound, 8 ounces. My parents did not know they were having twins at the time due to the lack of technology. The other baby did not survive. And I spent the first 2.5 months in Lenox Hill Hospital in an incubator. So, you know, it's a story that I've heard throughout my childhood, throughout my life, and shared it in the book. And, you know, it's amazing when I think back to how small that I actually was when I was born back in February of 1968.
Then your parents adopted another child, and then they had a set of twins.
Right. I went from an only child to four, to the oldest of four in less than 6 years. So the other three, my siblings, are all within 10 months of each other. And it was almost as if they were triplets. We had the triple stroller, and my mother would bring us to four consecutive haircut appointments or four consecutive doctor appointments. So we always seemed to do everything in fours.
I have to ask you, being the son of the great Marv Albert, people would think that you had an easy break into broadcasting, but that wasn't the case. I mean, I read in the book, you paid your dues starting at a small cable television station in Great Neck, Long Island.
Right. You know, I was so interested in sports and sportscasting from the time I was, you know, 4 or 5 years old. And I chronicle in the book, you know, my parents gave me a tape recorder for my birthday when I was real young, and I started to call games into the tape recorder, and it's really all I ever wanted to do. I was never forced to do it or told that I had to, you know, that I had to do this, but it was always such a passion. And that was a huge break in 10th grade when I was going to school in Port Washington, Paul D. Schreiber High School, covering a lot of the sporting events for the school newspaper and for the town paper, the Port Washington News. And by total coincidence, Cox Cable showed up at my high school to film a girls' basketball game. And they had two cameras and a production van, and that was it. So I volunteered to announce the game, met with the producer, the late Roy Menton, after the game, and he gave me the opportunity to work about 75 to 100 games over the next 3 years all over Long Island, basketball, baseball, hockey, football, soccer, lacrosse, you name it. And it was such a great experience. I would bring friends along as color analysts, and it was just invaluable experience. You know, back then, you couldn't really have the opportunity until college. These days, a lot of the high schools have terrific broadcasting programs, but back in the mid-80s, that wasn't the case. So I felt like I had a three-year head start.
Speaking of college, I have to mention it because your uncle, Al, was a goalie at Ohio University, and I am also a Bobcat.
Oh, nice.
We have that in common. So
he was a goalie there in the late 60s, early 70s. And when he wasn't playing, he would announce the games on the school radio station.
And then did he get drafted at a college? I thought
he did not get drafted. He went to a Ranger training camp. He was involved as a free agent. So he actually did attend a training camp when Emil the Cat Francis was the head coach and general manager.
I'm going to bounce around a little bit because every time as I'm reading, I'm like, I got to ask Kenny about this. I got to ask Kenny about that. The stories are great. There was one story that I just laughed because I pictured it. And it was the interview that wasn't. And that was when Michael Bloomberg was waiting. You were done. Everybody was basically gone for the night. You did an interview that nobody heard. Can you tell that story, please?
Right. That's one of my favorite stories in the book. 2003 American League Championship Series. It was the Aaron Boone game when Boone hit the home run to beat the Red Sox in extra innings and put the Yankees into the World Series. And I was the sideline reporter and post-game host in the clubhouse during this locker room celebration. So the game went late. It was about 12:30 a.m. when it finally ended, and Joe Buck and Tim McCarver were doing the game, and I'm in the Yankee clubhouse interviewing Joe Torre and Mariano Rivera and some of the other Yankees, and I threw it back upstairs to Joe and Tim, and then they threw it to the late local news. It was close to 1 a.m. at that point, and I saw out of the corner of my eye Mayor Bloomberg off to the side, and his public relations aide came over to me and whispered, "Can you have the mayor on next?" And I said, "Well, we're off the air." And he said, "Can you fake it?" He didn't want to lose his job. So the mayor came up, and I knew his mother was from Boston and was a big Red Sox fan. So I was formulating questions in my mind and wound up doing a 5-minute interview that never saw the light of day on television.
I love that story.
Yes, absolutely. But I'm going to go back to your college days. I want you to talk about when you went to NYU and you were part of the hockey club. Talk about that.
I had played hockey in high school on a club hockey team and always enjoyed playing hockey, played in some pickup games around the New York area. And I figured my hockey career was over once I was off to college at NYU. And the first month of college, I was walking through one of the main buildings after class, and I see a flyer up on the wall. And it says, "If anybody's interested in playing hockey, come to a meeting on such and such date in such room." So I went to this meeting, and a fellow student by the name of Matt Nafis, who was a couple of years older than me, came up with an idea to form a club hockey team. And I helped out with some of the administrative duties. I played on the team for 4 years and actually scored the first goal. I didn't score many, but I did score the first goal in hockey history.
All right.
Kenny, your voice, of course, is very distinctive. And of course, you know, you sound like your father. And in the book, you even mention that, you know, your kids will have been watching and it'll be like, guess the announcer. And it is true. Your father, Marv Albert, what a distinctive voice. Like he'd say, yes, you know, you just hear that. And, you know, when I think of your dad, How was it working with your father? Because I know in the beginning, you two worked together, or you worked for him or with him.
Well, I kept the statistics for him for many years at the Garden, at Ranger games, at Knick games, and then at football games as well. But we only really worked together on air three or four times. You know, since we have the same job, play-by-play, it's not really conducive to working together. Once in college, he came to NYU and helped out on a broadcast with us. And then I worked three or four Westwood One football games as the sideline reporter. He was doing the play-by-play with Boomer Esiason. So that was back in 2005. So we had a couple of opportunities to work together back in the day.
Now, you had a nice relationship with former NHL coach Barry Trotz. And you noted it was noted that you met him at a barbecue, a baseball BBQ, at a Baltimore Slipjacks hockey team. And you were his roommate. And you end up calling the Stanley Cup with him as head coach of the Washington Capitals. How amazing is that?
Right. I was so happy for him. I was also in the building when he won the Calder Cup with the Portland Pirates in 1994. So both times he's won a championship, I was in the building in one form or another. But we first met in the summer of 90 at that barbecue. I was hired by the Skipjacks to do the radio. He was the assistant coach. I was 22. He was 27 at the time. And we had a great relationship to save money. They had us room together on the road. In some cases at the minor league level, it's the bus driver with the radio announcer. But with our team, it was the assistant coach and the radio guy. So 2 years on the road, we were roommates and learned a lot from Barry, not about hockey, but not only about hockey, but about life in general. So he's a great man, a terrific coach, third winningest head coach in NHL history. And I was proud to be in the building that night when he won the Stanley Cup.
I'm sure you were. And can you tell us about your first radio broadcast out? I believe it was in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Something happened at the... Why don't you tell us about that?
Right. That was my first broadcast with the Skipjacks. I had done some fill-in work with the Islanders the prior season, and I was my own engineer. Again, at the minor league level, you do it all. And the former Penguins head coach, Gino Briaco, was my color analyst. And in the middle of the second period, I receive a note from the press box, call your station, you're off the air. One of us had accidentally knocked out the phone plug from the jack. That's how the radio signal was transmitted back in the day. And I thought that was it. I figured my career was over after one game, but we got it plugged back in and didn't have any problems the rest of the way.
Danny, you know, I would have thought that hockey, maybe, you know, you're very familiar with broadcasting it, but I would have thought hockey would have been one of the most difficult things to announce because, you know, it's constant movement. You got to watch the puck, all that. I was surprised that you said actually baseball was the most challenging. And then interesting, you said the ball is in play between 8 and 12 minutes during a typical 9-inning game. I had never thought of that. It's a lot of things you have to fill in.
With hockey, I think it's the easiest. It's like riding a bike. The puck's in action the entire time. And I think the continuous action is what makes it easy as a play-by-play announcer. Not everybody would agree due to the line changes on the fly and all the European names. But to me, it's the easiest personally. Basketball is similar, but it's 48 minutes, not 60. It's a little slower pace than hockey. Football is the most rhythmic. It's one play and then 20 or 25 seconds, another play, 20 or 25 seconds. Baseball, to me personally, is the most challenging. I only do 10 or 12 games a year, so I'm not there every day. And I think it did get easier this year, though, with the pitch clock. Prior to that, there was so much downtime. Like you said, the ball's only in action 8 to 12 minutes a game. And with the pitch clock, though, it sped things up, and there's not as much time to fill in between pitches and in between batters.
You know, I have to ask you this question. I'm very curious. How does it work when you broadcast for different networks? For example, you sometimes broadcast for Fox, while you're under contract, you might broadcast something for NBC. How does that work out?
Well, I work for three networks, Fox, TNT, and MSG. And prior to TNT, it was NBC. So the schedule is a bit of a jigsaw puzzle, but on Sundays, it's Fox football. On Wednesdays, it's TNT hockey. And many other days of the week, it's Rangers on radio or Knicks on television on MSG.
So there's no conflict of interest with the networks? I guess they don't care if you work on a different network.
Yeah, they're great about it. And there are many announcers that work on different networks. Mm-hmm. You know, look at Michael Strahan. He's on Fox on the weekends. He's on ABC during the week on Good Morning America. Many others. So they're all great about it, and the schedule kind of comes together like a jigsaw puzzle.
What I also found interesting about reading the book was how you have to juggle family life with, you know, with the announcing. You're always busy. You're always on the road, yet you're able to somehow, it must be hard to do it, you're able to be with the family as well. And you really got the, as I immerse myself in the book, I really got that feeling that you're here, you're there. You really feel that.
Well, it's a lot different than somebody that goes to an office from 9 to 5 every day, right? And then is at home nights and weekends. With me, it's sort of the opposite. I'm away every weekend and a lot of nights, but I am home more than others during the day. So when my kids were young, we made it work. They're older now. They're 20 and 24. So they're not living at home. But last week, for example, I was in LA Sunday, Madison Square Garden Monday, Boston Tuesday, Detroit Wednesday, MSG Thursday, and then back on the road to Seattle Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So not every week's like that, but that's just an example of what it was like last week.
Wow. Yeah, I'm sure. But I know the travel is brutal, but you go first class all the way.
I don't mind the travel. I get a lot of work done on planes and in hotels. And every once in a while, there might be a glitch or a delay. But for the most part, it's pretty simple, pretty easy.
Yeah, you talk about that in the book, too. There's so many wonderful stories in this book. But you talk about the times that you had to, you know, you had a snowstorm, you had different things. You had one story. You fell asleep on a plane. I can't remember the celebrity you were sitting next to, but you fell asleep next to that celebrity and you never even spoke to them. I forget who that was.
That was Mario Lopez. That was about 15 years ago. That was a red eye flight. So I think we both fell asleep pretty quickly.
Yeah. And also it's just as I'm reading and it's like, you know, this person like, okay, Reggie Jackson. What is it like meeting Reggie Jackson? I know you mentioned in the book he signed a baseball for you. How is that when you meet Reggie Jackson?
Well, I was only about 10 or 11 years old when that meeting took place, so right. I was so excited. As a kid, I used to eat the Reggie bars, and I was a big Yankee fan, so tagged along with my father and Dick Schaap, actually, when they interviewed Reggie. So that picture's still on my wall from over 45 years ago.
Nice. Yeah. You know, I'm an old school guy. I loved the Knicks from in the early 70s. And Walt Frazier was my favorite basketball player. I remember him signing an autograph picture for me, and I still have that in my memorabilia. What a pleasure you must have to work with Clyde.
Oh, he's the best. Such a gentleman. I've never seen him turn down a fan's request for an autograph or a photo. And just so exciting to work about 15 games with him per season for the last 12 or 13 years. And he's such a student of the game. He's the only person in the Basketball Hall of Fame as a player and as a broadcaster. So what a career he's had, and such an honor to have him as one of the names on the cover of my book, along with Wayne Gretzky.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, he's my favorite Nick. You know, he was just the best.
Here's a tidbit from the book. You sleep with your eyes partially open.
That's what I'm told. Partially. Once ran into trouble with a flight attendant who asked me a question and I did not answer. And she thought I was being rude, but I was asleep. My eyes were partially open that time.
Yes.
You wrote a lot of this book during the pandemic when you were home for several hundred days. But describe for us how it is to call a game during COVID off a monitor.
Well, I'm actually doing it tonight, Rangers-Calgary off the monitor from New York. We do 90 to 95% of the games in person these days, but there's the occasional game where we don't travel. But that brought me back to my childhood when I was calling games off the television in my bedroom. It's a little more challenging than calling the game when you're actually there in person, but we all got used to it. And I was home for 146 straight days, and then I went to the NHL bubble in Edmonton. So I was actually calling games in person for the next month or so. And, you know, that was quite the experience. We felt like we were in the safest place in North America. We were tested every day. The arena and the two hotels were inside a 10-foot fence, so we couldn't go anywhere. But we were calling two hockey games a day, playoff games, and in some cases, three. So it's a time period that I'll never forget. And called a lot of games off the monitors. I feel like you could see about 85% of what you would normally see if you were at the game. There are some things you might miss, but there's little tricks you learn along the way to make it sound like to the listeners and the viewers that you're actually there.
How is it calling games, hockey games outdoors? I mean, it must have been very cold.
You know, the cold isn't really the issue. Yes, it's cold in certain places, but we're so far away from the rink. So those are challenging games. They're a lot of fun. It's a great atmosphere. Fenway Park last year, Target Field in Minnesota the year before. I worked one at the Air Force Academy, but you're so much further away from the rink. So it's more challenging to see the uniform numbers.
So, Kenny, that was Jeff and I, we just stepped on each other. That was something that we got you have to avoid in the.
That's the first time in 20 minutes. Good job. Good job.
What I was going to ask you is two things. The first is how they decide that you're not going to Calgary. I mean, what plays into that decision that you're going to do it off a monitor?
I'm not sure exactly what goes into it. It's a 5-game road trip. Sam Rosen and Joe Micheletti are on the trip, the Ranger TV announcers. But for this particular trip, they kept the radio broadcast at home. But we'll be on most of the road trips this year.
And the other thing that I wanted to ask you is, as I'm reading the book and I'm writing notes, I thought to myself, I wonder if Kenny ever like makes mistakes. Like, does he ever accidentally curse? And then I'm reading and you actually talk about the fact that you don't curse in your regular life. And that way you don't have to worry about accidentally cursing on air, which was a great point.
Right. You never want to slip. So right. If you don't do it in real life, you're not going to do it on the air with a microphone in front of you.
Yeah, I thought that was good. So it answered my question before I even had a chance to ask it.
Tell us, you've broadcast from all the greatest venues in the world. I must say that Madison Square Garden must be the top of the top.
Definitely at the top of my list. I grew up going to events at the Garden. They went through a full renovation about 10 years ago. It's almost like a different building aside from the iconic ceiling. Love a lot of the traditional, you know, the older stadiums and arenas, Fenway Park, Lambeau Field, where I'll be this coming weekend. Wrigley, had the opportunity to work 3 NFL games at Wembley Stadium in London. That was a lot of fun as well.
While you were in Canada, you did broadcast in baseball the Juan Bautista bat flip. Wasn't that the game with Sin Su Chu? Also, the ball hit the bat, and there was a discussion.
Yeah, that was the same inning. That was the same inning. A lot of craziness took place. And along with Harold Reynolds and Tom Verducci, they did a great job explaining things. We were able to cite the rule after that play, and then the Bautista home run and bat flip. It's funny, I've done less baseball than the other sports, but that's the one moment that I get asked about the most. As far as favorite calls, and that's certainly up there in my top five, the Bautista home run bat flip back in 2015.
And you were in the stadium when Derek Jeter hit that home run that was controversial, that Jeffrey Mayer caught the ball. And then a decade later, you're in the same restaurant with his parents. How coincidental is that?
And I had no idea what happened. It was before texting and internet on the phone. I think cell phones were in their infancy back in 96. My wife and I were at the game, but we were sitting in the upper deck down the right field line, and we were shielded. We couldn't see what happened. So we had no idea what had taken place until we got home and heard about it on the news. And then about a decade later, as you mentioned, I met Jeffrey Mayer's parents in a restaurant in New Jersey.
Go figure. The stuff that happened, it's just so coincidental. And I love the tidbit that Monty Hall was once the voice of the Rangers. Who knew that?
Yep, true story.
And you have a good story in there. You worked with Jeff Torborg, and you guys were
that one.
Right? I guess it was you were at Shea, I guess, with Jeff, and he saw different busts, and he made a comment that he was the biggest bust as the Mets manager.
Said there should be a bust of me up there. I was a bust as Mets manager. Jeff was great, one of my favorite partners of all time.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard that he's extremely likable, really nice guy.
Great guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, do you have any memorabilia from the places that you've been to? I know you mentioned in the book you have a Yankee Stadium seat that was painted over.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or that I begrudgingly put in the book. I have a lot of programs and media guides. That's probably the biggest collection that I have. I do have some other memorabilia. I have a Thurman Munson bat. I have some baseballs and pucks, but I would say the bulk of my collection is programs and media guides from various games that I either worked or attended.
Now, you were like us, Kenny, when Thurman Munson passed away, you were a kid. And I guess you were at camp, much like us, during the summer when you heard that he passed away.
I'll never forget that day. August 2nd, 1979, I was 11 years old, and I attended camp at Kutcher Sports Academy in Monticello, New York. And we had just gotten back from the Orange County Fair, which was an annual event up about a half hour from our camp. And yeah, we heard the news when we got back that day, and it was so sad for everybody, you know, all the Yankee fans and baseball fans, but always remember where I was when I heard the news, for sure.
Yeah, I do as well. You broadcast the four major sports, but what's challenging about, you know, I mean, you broadcast horse racing, lacrosse, soccer, track and field. What makes those volleyball so challenging? Volleyball, yeah.
Right. Horse racing, I never actually called the race. I was the host of the show. So
okay,
I don't know how those guys do it who actually call the races. But back in the day in college, and then for a couple of years after, called some lacrosse and soccer. And I kind of convinced myself that was similar to hockey as far as the call. But boxing is a lot different. There's no ball or puck. I've done some track and field and volleyball. And to be honest, I went out and bought track and field for dummies, volleyball for dummies, watched a lot of prior tapes. When I was assigned to volleyball, I actually sat down with our local high school volleyball coach. And I said to her, tell me all about the strategy, the lingo, the history. And it was a great 90-minute lesson that taught me more than I ever knew about the sport of volleyball. And I had great analysts around me as well. But those are always challenging. And I love the variety. Really enjoy calling different sports, so I certainly have a lot of them on my list.
So, Kenny, you mentioned in the book that the hardest, not the hardest, but the one sport that you, if it was the most difficult, you mentioned wrestling, and that was the one you didn't feel comfortable with.
Yeah, only did it once. It was back in the mid-90s working for Home Team Sports in Washington. I was assigned to the ACC Wrestling Championships, and again, did a lot of homework, spoke to an Olympic wrestler named Jeff Blatnick, watched other tapes, and once we started, I really felt like I had no clue. Fortunately, I had a really good analyst that night who was able to carry me along.
The name of the book is A Mic for All Seasons, My Three-Decade Announcing the NFL, NHL, NBA, MLB, and the Olympics. Our guest is Kenny Albert. The foreword is written by Walt Frazier and Wayne Gretzky. And Kenny, what I really appreciate, what you put in the appendix in the book, are your scorecards, sample of scorecards. Now, I'm a baseball guy. I can score a baseball game. I've scored basketball games, but football, I'm a god. How do you score a football game? That was impressive. I have no idea what I'm looking at, though.
Well, what you saw in the book was the spotting chart, the spotting board from football, where it lays out the players by position, their name, their number, height, weight, college, how many years they've been in the league, statistics, other notes and nuggets. And then I'll keep track of the scoring plays on a separate sheet. But I did include the charts from basketball and hockey and baseball as well in the book. There's a chapter dedicated to young broadcasters, high school and college age, up and coming sportscasters. And I tried to pay it forward, talking about you know, some of the things that they should do, some advice as far as how they should handle things, what kind of internships they should look for, et cetera. So wanted to include those charts as well, just so they could see what some of the preparation looks like.
So Kenny, is it too late for Jeff and myself? I mean, we're, you know, I mean, we can't go back in time, but you know, maybe give us some advice.
Well, you guys are doing pretty well. So I'd say just keep on doing what you're doing. You did a lot of research. You read the book. Terrific interviewing skills.
Thank you, Kenny. We appreciate it. Boy, was I looking for a compliment there?
Yeah, I just want you to know, Kenny and I have a couple of connections because I used to be an intern for the Mets back in 84. Arthur Friedman, you mentioned the book, Jay Horowitz, Bob Murphy, the late Dennis D'Agostino, who was a great guy. I know you know him. Yeah, absolutely. And I actually went to college with a guy named Barry Watkins. Can you tell us about Barry? Yeah. Well, tell us about Barry.
Recently, the longtime PR guru at Madison Square Garden. So you're a St. John's guy.
I am.
Kenny, you mentioned Bob Murphy in the I guess he recorded an answering machine message for you.
He did. I was working with Howie Rose as an associate producer on Mets Extra. So I was at all the Mets home games. And back then we didn't have cell phones. We had actual answering machines. And in the dorm at NYU, my roommate was Rich Ackerman, longtime WFAN personality. And we actually had, I had Bob Murphy record the outgoing answering machine message for us. So whenever anybody called our apartment, our dorm, they heard Bob Murphy's voice if we didn't answer the phone.
Yeah. And you mentioned in the book, talked about sports phone, which I remember sports phone.
Right. I never worked there. A lot of my friends and colleagues did, but I was a frequent caller.
Yeah. Howie Rose was at sports phone. I remember. But, you know, it's Bob Murphy. I didn't have the experience that you did, but he lived right next to my high school, that he lived there. And I think we were freshmen in high school, and knocked at his door, and you hear, you know, well, who is it? You know, and Bob Murphy, it's like, that's Bob Murphy. And it was his wife answering the door, and we go in and was sitting at the table with them. What a nice guy he was.
Oh. A Hall of Fame broadcaster and such a distinctive voice. I always love listening to Bob Murphy.
Yeah, yeah.
Kenny, we thank you for your time. I got one last question for you, and it's about the connections again. Len mentioned Howie Rose. Howie Rose idolized your dad, had a fan club, Marv Albert fan club. And then you end up working with Howie Rose on what, Next Extra before and after the games?
I did. Things come full circle. He had that fan club when he was 14 years old, before I was born. And then Howie, when I was in college, offered me the opportunity to work with him as the associate producer of Mets Extra from 1987 through 1990. I learned so much from Howie. One of the top broadcasters of all time in New York with both the Rangers and Islanders and the Mets, and learned something every time I listened to him. And he was a great mentor and friend, and still keep in touch with him to this day.
Are your uncles still working? Al and Steve?
They're both retired. Al and Steve had long careers doing play-by-play.
Yes,
both very happy living in the New York area. They're involved in a couple of projects here and there, but for the most part, they're retired.
Kenny, can you set the record straight for everyone that the announcers are not jinxes? When you're watching a game, if you say that there's a no-hitter going on, you didn't just ruin that.
Despite what some of the public thinks, I have nothing to do with breaking up shutouts in hockey, no-hitters in baseball, missed field goals in football. I wish I had those powers. I really do.
You'd use them for good and not evil.
Exactly.
But you actually talk in the book about the fact that you haven't broadcast a no-hitter or a perfect game. You had the opportunity, but you had to do another event.
Rangers playoff game, and it turned out Phillip Umber pitched a perfect game for the White Sox in a game that I was initially assigned to work. So I have not broadcasted a no-hitter, haven't even seen one in person.
But you'd like to, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely.
But you would jinx it.
Probably.
Is there another generation of Alberts coming along?
My daughter, Amanda, my older daughter, works behind the scenes in production at the NHL. She's a video editor / producer. So she's doing a great job there. Not on the air, but behind the scenes. She won an Emmy Award a couple of years ago working with the Olympics for NBC with her group. So, you know, very proud of the work she's done.
Oh, you know, we didn't ask you about the Olympics. How was the Olympics? You went to Russia, didn't you?
Went to Russia, went into the Dead Sea. It was 60 degrees in February. Have some photos and video. I love working the Olympics. I've worked 8 of them, 6 in person, 2 out of the studio. But it's such a fun time. Sochi, Russia, Pyeongchang, South Korea, Vancouver, Torino, Salt Lake City, Rio, Brazil. For the most part, it's been hockey, men's and women's hockey. 6 Winter Olympics, also called track and field at a Summer Olympics, volleyball, a couple of baseball games as well. So it's a lot of fun.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
This is all in the book, A Mike for All Seasons, and so much more. We, as they say, we have not even scratched the surface, but Kenny, your time is valuable. We greatly appreciate it. Loved the book. We hope you are extremely successful with it, and thank you very much for joining us on Baseball and Barbecue.
Jeff, Len, really appreciate it. So thrilled that you read the book. Great questions. The book has its own Instagram account, which my daughter runs. It's a Mike for All Seasons on Instagram. Pictures of the book all over North America at various sporting venues. So check that out. But again, thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it. And hopefully we can do it again one day.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings podcast. And if you like barbecue and you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Len. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out. Baseball and BBQ with Len and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
And thank you, Kenny. Len, I really love that story where he interviewed Mayor Bloomberg. Do you remember? You remember seeing that on TV?
You know, when I listen to that again, because I'm thinking to myself, you know, how could Mayor Bloomberg not know, you know, not going out on the air? But when you think about it, if he's there, it's not like he's running home and saying, oh, let me watch myself on TV.
Right.
That's unbelievable. That I loved that story. I really did. But you know what I also love, Jeff?
What's that?
I love baseballbbq.com. I do.
Why is that?
Well, because they've got incredible grilling tools and accessories. And you know what? The holidays, they're close, but they're not over. And I'm sure that if you go to baseballbbq.com and you see something that you really want, like grilling tools and accessories with baseball bat handles, and you get in right away, hopefully you could get them by the holidays.
And Len, if you go on X or Twitter, they do run contests. So go to baseballbbq, at baseballbbq on X, and follow them. And if you want to follow us, our Twitter is at baseballandbbq. Our phone number is 516-855-8214. Email us, baseballandbbq@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our Facebook page. Leave a comment on Instagram, Baseball and BBQ, with barbecues all spelled out. Our website is www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. Please rate, review, subscribe, tell your friends. Anything else, Len?
I just want to say that it's 6 years, and it kind of snuck up on us, didn't it?
It did.
It really did. So if you want to call and give your thoughts on the show, be kind, please. We would love to hear from you. Email us, call us, whatever. We know we have some very faithful listeners. We thank you all for that. It's been a great 6 years. We are so lucky to have guests like Kenny Albert and our next guest, Jeff. But actually, you know what? Wait, before we get to our next guest, we can't miss this.
The baseball quote of the week.
Baseball is dull, only to dull minds. That's the great announcer, Red Barber.
Yes. Good point. Red Barber. Speaking of Red Barber, we had on the authors who wrote that great book on Red Barber. Anyone who's been listening to the show knows I don't know what episode it is. I can't tell you the authors, but I just know we had two great authors and a great book on Red Barber.
Len, that was episode 165, Jim Walker and Judith Heltner.
Yeah. Husband and wife.
Yes.
The book, Red Barber. Really, really great. And actually, it's appropriate that you mentioned that the quote was Red Barber because Kenny Albert, another great announcer. Speaking of great, the segues just keep coming, Jeff. Paul Holden is our next guest. And Paul Holden is the owner of Willingham's. And that is the company started by John Willingham, who's in the Barbecue Hall of Fame. So let's just get right to it and let's let you hear what Paul has to say and hear his story. Baseball and barbecue listeners, we have with us another world championship barbecue pitmaster from a award-winning team. This team has been winning the most prestigious awards for over 40 years, including Memphis in May, the American Royal, the Jack Daniel's Invitational, and the World Food Championships. Founded by John Willingham, John was famous for barbecue and the sauces and rubs he developed, as well as a unique cooker, which we'll get to enhance all these great cooking techniques. The Willingham team is now run by our guest, who is a champion pitmaster all on his own. Their mission is a commitment to excellence and the integrity of every product we offer, a pledge to help everyone to discover the thrill and realization of the joys of barbecue, and the Willingham vision that a family that cooks together, as they play together, stays together. We welcome Paul Holden to Baseball and Barbecue. Welcome, Paul.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Welcome, Paul. How are you doing?
Yeah, doing pretty good.
Great, great.
Jeff, that was an excellent intro. Jeff wrote that. I have to give him credit. That was very good, Jeff.
Well, thank you very much.
Absolutely. It's humbling to hear it, actually.
Yes. So, Paul, give us John Willingham's origin story and how he started Willingham's Barbecue.
Yeah, so probably longer time than we've got today. I'm as long-winded as John, I think, was. But, you know, he really had a passion for barbecue, I think, his entire life. And he was in the late 70s. He was in a car accident, was convalescing, and, you know, really started to think a lot about barbecue and cooking techniques. And, you know, I think he had dabbled with it over the years and, you know, really buckled down during that time period when he was in recovery, came up with the cooker, came up with the marinade that we still give today or still sell today, and then the original mild seasoning. So the two things he really worked on. You know, coming out of that, he and his brother built the original version of the cooker back in 78 and then just ran with it in Memphis, right? Opened the restaurant and then got into the competition scene and then got into the vending scene. Just really one of his passions his entire life.
Wow. Well, let's talk about that for a second. You mentioned the cooker. So that is, of course, one of the things I've seen videos on YouTube. I've seen, you know, I've heard people talk about, you know, John had 17 patents. He was an engineer, right? He was quite the inventor. Yeah. And he made this, that's the Willingham Turbo Cooker. He invented it. And not only are do the meats hang, but they spin.
They rotate.
Yes. Slowly, very slowly.
Yeah, it's, and I still use the cookers on the circuit. This year I was trying something different, but for the most part, they still go out there. But the whole concept, we actually held the patent on indirect and offset cooking. So a lot of these cookers you see out there today are based upon our patent from the 80s of heat source on, which isn't a new concept. I mean, they've been doing that for thousands of years, but the cooking apparatus where you have the heat source off to the side, and then you're using that convection to actually cook the meat. And, you know, a step further that he took with the Wham Turbo Cooker is, you know, smoke is bad. The carcinogens in it, right, aren't good. So that indirect heat with a little bit of smoke flavor wisping through. And then the other piece with the rotation, because a lot of cookers out there, you do have rotisseries that go on a horizontal and they just rotate, but you get hot spots in any of the corners of the cooker. Because we're a vertical cooker and we hang, the meat is constantly rotating through the heat source. So I don't care if the back corner's hot, the bottom corner, it doesn't matter because it's constantly getting even distribution of heat. So I can cook in that cooker, you can see on the website, 4 slabs of ribs or 42 slabs of ribs in it, and they all take the exact same amount of time. So whether it's a 4-hour cook or a 5-hour cook, 4 ribs or 42 will be exactly the same, which is just, I don't know how the man figured that out during that time period, especially back in the late 70s. But it just, it's an amazing cooker and a lot of fun, and it brings a lot of attention. It draws people in.
Oh yeah,
I think part of his design factor on it with the funny roof line and the wheels was really to draw people in, because it starts the conversation and we can share the trade. We can share the craft with people, you know, whether they buy a cooker or not wasn't important, but it was teaching them how to cook good barbecue or cook good, you know, grill good things. So but conversation starter.
And not only are you doing ribs in it and brisket, but you're cooking whole hogs in these.
Yes, absolutely. So that one cooker, this picture on the website, I can put an 86-pound whole hog in there, and it hangs and it rotates just like the ribs and everything else. It just spins for a little bit longer, probably 12, 14 hours. But yeah, and it's amazing because unlike traditional cooking processes, because it's hanging, the juices are constantly rendering over the meat throughout the process. So it doesn't dry out. And on a whole hog, the loins are just as moist as the ham. And it's a lot of fun. We have a commercial version that, you know, some restaurants have that you can do three in or two really big ones. And then we've got our old competition cooker that we used to use at Memphis and May. You could put five Memphis and May hogs in, regulation size hogs in there at the same time. It was a show.
Wow. Yeah. I'm assuming that the heat source is wood, but could you also use charcoal?
Yeah. So actually all of them are. So the new stainless steel ones are multi-fuel. So I could take the pellet feeder off because we're currently using pellets on those. I put the door on it and I could run lump charcoal. I could run briquettes or I could run stick, and the same cooking convention still works. And I think all but a couple of the cookers are multi-fuel like that.
Paul, those are amazing cookers. As far as how often are you approached by companies that want to, by either people like us who say, you know, we'd love to buy one,
yeah,
by companies that say we'd like to manufacture them and sell them, or by pitmasters that are like, we want to use those, sell them to us?
Yeah, so I've got the last one we made was in 2016, delivered that one up to Boise, Idaho, of all places. And I've been working with a new stainless steel fabricator since then, you know, tweaking it a little bit. And, you know, stainless steel prices have been all over the place, especially during the pandemic. But I think we're going to start, hopefully in 2024, start putting them out. I've got a list of about 30 people that would probably send me a check right now as a deposit. But until I know they're going into manufacturing, I won't do that.
Right. And you know, Paul, talking to you and I've heard you do other interviews, and it's almost like going on a date with someone, and before they talk about themselves, they need to talk about their family.
Mm-hmm.
It's because your beginning is really when you met, your beginning in barbecue, of course, is when you met John.
Yeah.
And before that, of course, I'm sure you knew how to cook or learned how to cook, but
barely. No, I did. I was thrown into the kitchen at a very early age. My grandparents lived with us, and my grandmother, I think I was probably first grade and in the kitchen cooking. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was, she had us in there early. So learned a lot. And, then I met, you know, John at my first Memphis in May in 91. Then the next year I started just hanging out with him and learning as much as possible. And then his son-in-law and I took over the team probably about 2008, you know, before he had passed. And so we got more and more deep into it. And then, you know, he passed in 13. My wife and I ran the company for him for the family for a couple of years, and then we ended up buying the business for the family. Family's still involved, right? So it's not, mm-hmm. you know, completely isolated from them. They're on the board of directors, and they help with cooks and contests and, you know, different strategies that we're trying to grow the business out. So it's still a family-owned business, just, you know, new face.
But you did, so you actually attended Memphis in May on your own before you met John. You had a desire and you were into barbecue before you even met John.
Yeah, I was working for a home healthcare management company in Memphis, and we had a company team down there, and off I went. And of course I was young and eager to learn and started talking to everybody. And John never met a stranger, so that made it a lot easier. And, you know, welcomed you into the booth, whether you were a competitor or just somebody off the, you know, in the park. Yeah. So it just became a good friendship over the years.
Jeff, did you know that John Willingham was a pitcher in the Cardinals organization?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You yes, did sir. Your research. Yeah. Yes.
You go back to, what is it, 53. He joined up with the Cardinals, drafted by the Cardinals. Korea got in the way, so he played out the first season with one of their farm teams, feeder teams, in St. Joseph, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And then went to Korea, came back, and then finished out the first season of 55 with another one of their farm teams. And then in 56, moved on up to with the Cardinals, pitched for a while, and then injured his wrist and ended up finishing the season out as the catcher.
Right, so, pitcher and catcher, exactly, yes.
Yeah, so he multifaceted guy.
Well, you know, going back to his history in barbecue, started, like you said, in his late 70s, 80s, and looking at the list of championships, this guy was, oh my God, this guy knew. He won first place world champion, grand champion, Memphis in May, American Royale. And like we said, like Len said in the intro, this guy was, he's one of the first Hall of Famers, the barbecue Hall of Famers, American Royale.
Yeah, he was the first, right? He was inducted in before the American Royal took it over. It was just the barbecue Hall of Fame.
That's right.
Yeah. So, and we hold the, was it 84? So we won Memphis in May in 84 and also won the American Royal. So we're the only team to have ever won the American Royal and Memphis in May in the same year. And I think we're the only team, actually I know we are, at Memphis in May, we've won the rib category, we won whole hog. The only thing we've not won there is shoulder, and that's my quest. I'm gonna get that, and then we'll have the trifecta. We'll be the only team to have ever won all three. Yeah, just of all the major contests, and then I think he missed a good opportunity, but it was later in his career, with all the TV shows. But he sprungboard. I can't tell you how many of the teams out there and the cooks out there, you know, just with the techniques and the seasoning and sauces and such. Still to this day, you know, like I could name a dozen teams or more that still use us as a base.
Now, Paul, you and John's son-in-law competed one day after John passed away. You competed in Memphis in May. I'm sure that at the encouragement of the family, they probably said this is what John would have wanted, right?
Yeah.
And you did quite well. You took 23rd in ribs out of 198 teams, and that was in 2013.
Yeah. Yeah, it was and there's a little story on that Memphis in May that year. So for 15 plus years, maybe longer, John had been begging or prodding, I should say, Memphis in May International to allow a cook team to vend out of their cooking space. You could vend, but you had to go up to vendor row, and you could compete, but you competed. And one of the complaints about Memphis in May has always been, hey, well, how do I get this great barbecue if I'm just, you know, paid $40 at the gate to get in, and you can't? So he was permitted as a test pilot that year to vend out of our competition space. So we had both trailers there. I was in charge of competition, and then John and the family and 35 of our closest friends were going to take care of all the vending. Of course, he passed, and being a big name in Memphis, you know, I was doing 300 slabs of ribs a day, plus the other meats. And it was a wild success for somebody, but the team took over. I mean, we're family, right? So everybody was there to volunteer, just stepped up and said, this is what John would want. And, you know, we let the family, you know, mourn and do what they needed to do. But they, you know, they were down there Friday, Saturday, and we did this. We had a service on Sunday, and we all came as we were, right? And just coming off of cooking, and probably all didn't smell that good. I had one of the trailers parked in the church parking lot for the service. So, I mean, it was true barbecue family. And, you know, obviously he was a big community leader there, being on the county commission and everything.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the community of barbecue around John Willingham.
Yeah.
Because, and like you said, he sounded like he was a beloved man, mm-hmm. who loved what he's doing, loved to his craft. And it must have been thousands of people at this service.
Yeah, it was packed. I mean, the whole community of Memphis was there. And he was, again, he was also a county commissioner there. heavy into the politics. Yeah, it was a pretty crowded service memorial for him. It was humbling and nice. I think the family was humbled by all the gestures and the outpouring of the community. And it was it's actually a big loss in Memphis because John passed on Wednesday night. Silky Sullivan passed on Thursday night. So another barbecue great there. And then founder of Corky's also died that weekend. So three in a row right there in a few days. Don Peltz. So,
Paul, tell us. I found that you have there's a tradition after a contest. I don't know if it's every contest or if it's just specific ones, but you eat hot dogs.
Yeah.
The wow, Wham
you really
dog.
You were doing some digging.
I dug so deep. I could put bodies in that hole.
Yeah.
That's how much I dug.
Yeah, it's we do. So that was something John started at Memphis in May. We generally only do it there, but we're all done. Awards are done. We come back and we throw, you know, some hot dogs on the cooker and we hang them. We've got little racks and little pins for those and hang hundreds of hot dogs on there. And that's one of the things. We also do what we call Wham dogs, which is take our original mild seasoning, coat the hot dogs with that. But yeah, that's sort of after all that rich food that we eat for a week and taste and test. And it's like, gee, you know what? Just a hot dog and maybe a nice whiskey would be good. So
we know one person that wouldn't partake in that. That's our, do you know Doug Scheiding?
No, I don't.
Oh, so he's a friend of the show, long running guest co-host. He will not put a hot dog, right, Doug? I know you're listening, Doug. He will not put a hot dog on his cookers. He refuses. Even if a little kid is there and like wants a hot dog, not on his cookers.
Yeah, I won't do that during a cook, but you know, the way our cookers work, you just hang them. It doesn't make a difference, but I can see it. I mean, I could see that. I could see people not wanting to do that, especially on some of these offsets and stick burners. Well, you don't want that flavor on there.
Right.
That's crazy.
And Paul, you competed in the World Food Championships.
We did. Yeah.
Tell us about that experience and how'd you do? What is it like cooking there?
Wow. Completely different than anything we have ever done in our barbecue career, whether, you know, out of all the formats. So everything is served on a silver platter and you don't have to be the traditional KCBS, MBN formats, you know, pick your sanctioning body that goes in a styrofoam box, but it literally plated food. You can go a little bit out of your normal barbecue range. I mean, flowers and decoration. I mean, it is intimidating. So we had to do ribs, chicken, and what was the third? Brisket. We had to do those three things down there. So first trip down, you know, there's 20 of us that made it to the World Foods that year. We took third in ribs. I missed a perfect score by a quarter point. The guys got first place and second place tied because they had perfect score. And we took 10th in brisket and 12th in chicken. So I think ended up 11th overall. I was thrilled. We also cooked three whole hogs while we were down there just for demo purposes and showing off a little bit. So they had a bourbon and rib tasting test. And we also did hogs for that. So it was a blast. Crazy format though. Intimidating because you walk into the arena and it's just little kitchen set up, you know, probably 100 on each side of the arena. And you just people doing bacon and pastries and soups and sandwiches and just intense, right? Some of the chefs that are there are just amazing. And then they have, you know, the two barbecue contests that are associated with. And they changed the format up again this year. We could have gone back just timing wise. It didn't work out.
Do you have a specific distributor of meats or chicken or poultry that you buy from?
Yeah, so I deal with a guy in San Antonio, Texas, of all places, that he sources most of our competition meat and will trim it for me. So it's pretty much ready to roll. I generally like to get my own chicken, which I get from Springer Mountain. You know, they're in Georgia, so pretty easy to get to. And then Prairie Fresh or Compart pork products. I think the Prairie Fresh tend to be a little bit better cuts of meat. Then I like the flavor of the Compart, but they just seem thin to me. And then I bounce between Snake River Farms, and then I wandered upon a new American Wagyu producer here. They're up in Minnesota called the Good Silver Steak Company. And I'm fascinated by their meat. It is red. So I guess there's red and black Wagyu is the, you know, the DNA traits, but they've blended it with New Jersey cattle. New Jersey cattle is already known for its superior tenderness. And these things, not only are they well marbled, but they're just, you know, like a brisket. It's just super jiggly, you know. So I've been cooking those the last four contests, and we've been doing, I think, pretty good with them. They cook different than a Snake or some of the other Wagyu brands out there. But we took third this past weekend down in Demopolis, Alabama. Christmas on the River, longest running Christmas festival, I think, in the United States. Or
really?
It's been going on since like 1971.
I'm just wondering, I assume you're seasoning all these meats with the Willingham's Wham seasonings?
Yep. Yeah. I'll kick in a few other of my friendly competitor products that blend very well. I mean, it's with today's competition style, whether it's KCBS, MBN, GBA, you pick one, there's a layering effect going on. I wouldn't say it's the barbecue, competitive barbecue that John was used to in the day, right? It was really a smoked meat competition back then. It's a lot more gourmet, if you will. So we do have to take and blend a little bit of extra things here and there. But for the core part, it's Willingham seasoning and it's Willingham sauces.
And I guess John came up with all these different mm-hmm. seasonings. There's original mild Cajun, lost at sea. There's hot stuff. Yeah. Also marinades.
Yeah. Yeah, so like I said, the marinade started it all, followed by original mild. Lost at Sea is our newest addition to the family. It's something he and I were playing with, you know, prior to his passing. We didn't know what it was going to be. Mm-hmm. I found a crusty old bag of it in a box, you know, when we bought the company and had it remanufactured, reproduced. And I'm like, okay, well, what is this going to be? I happened to try it on sea bass. And Clay, John's son-in-law, was with me. I said, I think this is a seafood seasoning. What are we going to call it? What was the lost recipe? And we both looked at each other and said, Lost at Sea. So that's our newest one. And it just took first place this year at the National Barbecue and Grilling Association Awards of Excellence. So out of hundreds of entries. So super, super excited about that. And it's slowly but surely getting out on the market. We are not big on John was never a believer of marketing. He believes, you know, your true market share by word of mouth. We have to do a little bit of marketing, and it's more the social media aspects of it and just, you know, posting our act, you know, what we're doing and things like that. And that it's starting to take better traction. But when we ship nationally, I think we'll ship about 20 tons of product by the end of the year.
While we're there, why don't we just tell everybody to go to willinghams.com, mm-hmm. go to the shop page, and there's all the seasonings and sauces and merchandise that you can purchase.
Yeah. Yep.
But let's explain one thing, and I'll let Paul explain it, because if you look at the prices, so here, like Wham seasoning original mild, it goes from $9.25 up to $225.
Yeah.
Now, I like to make good barbecue, but I can't spend $225. Sure, so, but yeah. Paul, explain that price is there. So
individual bottles are $9, but we also have a big food service business. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot, you know, most of them are wholesale. So they, you know, they log on, they're getting their wholesale pricing for that. But some people do, like competition teams, want to buy a 24-pound box or a 50-pound right. box of seasoning. And but we've got so that's the price differential when you look and I go, well, what's $225? Well, that's a 50-pound box. And believe it or not, we do have individuals that order it. But mostly it's restaurants, and it's not just barbecue joints, right? We've got several barbecue restaurants around the country that order the seasoning. call it their own, and that I'm happy with that. But we have steak restaurants. I guarantee you've eaten it at some of them. We've got Mexican restaurants. We've got home cooking. We've got Italian restaurants that order either the Cajun or the original mild. Pizza joint up in north of Pittsburgh orders and uses the sauce on their pizza.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's I'm always thrilled and intrigued by what people cook with it, right?
Don't you have there's a restaurant I saw in, I think in California?
Yeah, Redondo Beach, California. So Pilwang bought a license from us, oh boy, a long time ago when he was in South Korea. Had a Willingham's restaurant. We shipped a cooker. We used to ship the seasonings and stuff over there. And he was running a little barbecue delivery service in South Korea, in Seoul.
Oh, wow.
And then he moved to the States and then reopened the restaurant in Redondo Beach. Does a great job. Does, you know, I would say sticks 90% to the restaurant recipes we've and techniques we always have done. You know, he has to modify it a little bit for the region he's in, right? I mean, if they want avocado on their pulled pork sandwich, I guess they can have it. But, you know, he does a good job, gets great reviews. He actually came out to Memphis in May this year and helped us. So it was good to spend some, you know, more time with him. And it was 10 years since he last was there. He came the year that John passed to help us.
But why one restaurant, Paul? Why not world domination?
Yeah, world domination. So we used to have some other licensees in Indiana and Michigan, you know, for whatever reason over the years, they didn't make it. Our last restaurant in Memphis, boy, we closed that, it had to be 2008, 2009. We had a great restaurant before that one that burnt. I mean, it was a cool building, old rickety floors, wood, and it caught on fire. So we opened one up in a old Shoney's, and that just never, it wasn't the right atmosphere. And yeah, I think, you know, John was getting later in life too. So it was his heart in running a restaurant. I don't know. Secretly, we are looking for property. And if I can find the right building in Memphis, we will open up a new place.
Oh, okay. That's secret. Jeff,
that's a secret. relatively secret.
Right.
We've been actively looking for a couple of years, but finding a good piece of property that's in the right area, that has a good draw and has that barbecue joint feel. I don't want to put it in a, and Phil Wang does a good job in California. He's in a strip mall, but I don't want to be in a strip mall. I want a freestanding, shacky type building that you feel like you're getting something, you know, authentic. And I think we'd do well in Memphis again.
Well, I mean, Paul, you know, that you've seen there are barbecue places in churches. There are barbecue places in gas stations. I mean, it's unbelievable where even in New York here, there's a barbecue place that opened and he had converted a gas station.
Yeah.
And it was a barbecue place. And now
we've looked at a couple buildings like that. It's like an old fire, actually a little old fire station. It's got just two bays, but it was built, you know, probably in the 60s. I'm like, oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
And then zoning wouldn't allow you to do it. Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Moving on from that one. But we got a couple of ideas, right, on some areas in the greater Memphis area that could potentially be a target and some properties. And the good news is John's son-in-law, Clay, is a real estate agent in Memphis. So he's always on the lookout for me for what we want to do there. But it's getting about time. We've got to do something.
Yeah.
Get back.
Do you do barbecue full time?
I do right now. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask to follow up on Len, that now that it's, you know, the winter time, what do you do? Since there's really less competitions going on now, I guess you're focusing on the retail business of the sauces and rubs.
Yeah, this is the time when we retool a little bit on the, you know, getting caught up on product updates and manufacturing and, you know, get back into the test kitchen, because I've got a laundry list of seasoning and sauces and things that either John started, I started, and a couple of ideas that I've got on my own. So we'll work on those over the winter. Competition starts back up in mid-February. I've got, and we're going to do the, we're going to go down and visit Myron Mixon on New Year's Eve for the hog drop in Unadilla, Georgia. So he's got a little 25 team GBA barbecue festival down there. One, you know, it's three meats, but it's, yeah, it's just a little bit of a party. I'm going to go cook with Chef Philip Dell. So he was he's a Willingham brand ambassador, but he's also won Chopped season 15.
Okay.
So the guy is, he has got the presentation skills and he's a great chef. So it's a lot of fun to cook with him. So we're going to team up and see what he can, what the Willinghams and the Barbecue Asylum can do together and tear it up down there a little bit. So that should be fun. But yeah, we do that. You know, I've been doing this full time since March. I was with an insurance company startup for a few years. I've been in the insurance tech industry for most of my career, starting back in even in Memphis. And so slowly easing out of corporate world into focusing on the seasoning and sauce and cooker manufacturing and maybe the restaurant.
A lot more fun.
You know, it's I get to talk to great people. Well, not that I had great people I worked with too. So that's probably not right to say if they're listening. But it's a little bit, I don't know, feeding people, talking with people just seems a whole lot better than generating insurance premium or, you know, reports or data and claims. But, you know, it was a good living in a great industry. So I can't complain. It's afforded me to maybe step out and do something different now later in life.
Actually, the Myron Mixon Festival down in New Year's Eve, is that by invitation only?
You sign up and then they select. You sign up? Yeah.
Len, you want to go?
You should come down.
I'm cooking with Paul. Let's go. Yeah,
come on. Hey, come on down. We'd love to have you. It's a nice little, I've never been. A few of my competitor friends are, they've done it a few years in a row. And it's, you know, it's a small little town in South Georgia, and Myron's the mayor also, which
is he really?
Yeah, he just got reelected for his like third term.
Oh, they don't have term limits, I guess.
I guess not. But he does a good job with the city, and so this is his sort of his annual festival. And his son, I think about 4 years ago, decided to do a barbecue contest and call it the Hog Drop, right? Peach Drop in Georgia, or the millennium, you know, whatever the ball, you know, in Times Square. Right. It's their version of it, which is, I don't know, it's going to be fun. Something different. I've never done it.
So, Paul, is the plan then to expand the line, or are you good with what you have now as far as the rubs and sauces?
Yeah. So I've got two more things on the agenda for. Got two seasonings that I've been kind of working at to try to get a couple of contemporary things in place on the seasoning side. And then sauce wise, you know, we've got most of our sauces are more vinegar based. So they're more Kansas City or even the Carolina flavor profile and Memphis. Our sweet and sassy 40-year-old recipe just won third at the National Barbecue and Grilling Association this year too. So it's not that they're not still hitting it, but there's a lot of, we need something a little bit sweeter, you know, for today's palates. And then I just want to get another blend of seasoning that's got a little bit more red to it. So I got a couple of ideas that we've been, stuff that John started, stuff that I've started. I'm just trying to merge that together, but I'm not, you know, I look at some of my competitor friends, and, you know, they've got 20 or 30 SKUs. I don't even know where to begin, right, with that. And there's no offense to them. You know, God bless them if they can figure out how to do it. I just, you know, to me, it's a concentrated success rate, right? Right. And when I look at things like the Original Mild, you know, we're producing in bulk for the restaurant customers 6,000-7,000 pounds a month. So,
wow. That's a lot of.
It's a lot of seasoning, right? Yeah. So, and then everything else is just sort of more retail. So I think, you know, our big focus, get a couple of more on the list, and then just keep trying to proliferate it out, you know, out to different other regions. We ship all over the world, but I'm trying to find a few more retail stores around the country, especially out west. Mm-hmm. And we're not, you know, I'm not looking for the Walmarts, the big box retailers. Right. I love being in the small grill shops where it becomes very personable, right? And they can learn the products, they learn their customers. You know, butcher shops, we do great in butcher shops, right? Because bottle of it sitting right there and they're grabbing fish, they're grabbing steaks or whatever, and they grab a bottle and they go out. So we've had a lot of success in that. So it's just getting out to more and more of them. That's the big concentration for the winter, to get a game plan for 24.
And also, if you're a fan of the show Shark Tank, a lot of times they'll tell the inventors on the show, you have too many products, too many SKUs to maintain. And they'll say, focus on, you know, the few. And so I think you know, Mark Cuban would approve of what you're doing.
that would be good. It's just a lot. I mean, I said there's a few that I'm really good friends with, and I love some of their products. And then it's just when you start to get wider, I'm like, I don't know what I do with all that. Right.
And Paul, we greatly appreciate your time. And I just have one more. This is leading the witness, because I already know your feeling on this, but I want other people to know. In competitions, what's your feeling on the use of sauce? Not the dependence more on sauce in competitions.
I like how you said that. So I was trained no sauce, right? So if you don't enjoy the flavor of the cooking process, the meat, the seasoning, and I don't even think you should overpower it with seasoning either. I think sauce covers up bad meat or good meat. And so it's become such a sauce competition out there. And I wish the sanctioning bodies or another sanctioning body would come along and just say, cut the sauce. Right. Let's have a smoked meat competition, because I enjoy a good just dry rub rib or brisket or, you know, pulled pork. Right. Nice bark on it. But if we put bark into a box now, we get dinged because, oh, it's this untender piece of meat. That's bark off of the pulled pork. That's money.
Yeah.
We do it reluctantly. But I refuse. Well, I've got teams out that they sauce brisket. I absolutely refuse to sauce brisket. I'll take whatever score I get. I'm not saucing it. A little au jus, that's fine. That's different, but not sauce.
Well, what about I've seen people, and this is like somebody putting ketchup on a hot dog, although maybe people do that, but I've seen people put ketchup on a ketchup on a brisket. I've seen people have a brisket sandwich and they put ketchup on it. I mean,
no thanks.
Yeah, not good.
No, it's like putting not on a steak, not on a
right.
I mean, people want to make a steak sauce, we'll take our a tablespoon of our original or our marinade and mix it with ketchup, and it actually makes a really good dipping sauce, you know, for even for like shrimp or something. But yeah, no, you don't ruin a good piece of meat with that.
Right. Yes, exactly. So, and I won't ruin this great interview by asking you any other ridiculous questions.
Oh, no, I like those aren't ridiculous questions. That's all fun.
I'll let Jeff wrap it up, but Paul, sure. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us.
One question before we wrap is to ask our pitmasters, what is the most unusual type of meat that you have smoked?
Iguana. Yeah, okay. we did an iguana entry at Memphis in May in 2015. Hung it. It was spinning around in that cooker. It was something to see. I don't know how well it tasted, but it was fun.
Well, I was going to ask you, how does somebody know if it's good iguana if they've never had it?
I don't know. I'm like, well, we're turning it in. It doesn't taste like chicken.
And what temp do you cook iguana to?
We sort of ran it like we did, like you would do alligator or chicken. Gotcha. Right. So about, you know, 165, 175. And, you know, it was tender. It's just, I don't know, just not a lot of flavor to it, and sort of kind of stringy, I guess. But it was fun to cook, because people would walk by the booth going, what do you got in there? Because this big long tail and
oh,
pretty, just wrapped around the carousel. It was hilarious. But yeah, that's probably the weirdest thing that I have cooked.
And before we let you go, please let us know your social media and how people can order your products.
Yeah, so website is willinghams.com. And social media for Facebook, it's Willingham Sauces. And for Instagram, it's Willinghams_barbecue.
Excellent. Paul, we greatly appreciate you joining us on Baseball and Barbecue.
Yeah.
And we wish you the best of luck with going forward with Willinghams.
Yeah, I appreciate the time. This is a lot of fun.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thank you, Paul. Jeff, I love hearing about, I mean, I love hearing the history. There's so much history in barbecue. Just, I mean, that's not even, you know, years and years, but it's just really amazing what John Willingham invented.
Yeah.
Hanging and the food and then on a rotisserie, or I mean, you know, where it rotates, and that's incredible. And what Paul has done with the company, how mm-hmm. he's taken it so far. And just, we thank you, Paul, for joining us. I don't think he knew that it was our 6-year anniversary. I don't think Kenny knew. We didn't know. But I'm very glad that we had Kenny Albert and Paul Holden to join us to celebrate 6 years. And Jeff, should we do a 7th?
I think we should do a 7th.
All right. Jeff said we should do a 7th. So for anyone who is worried, don't worry. We're coming here for a 7th year. But you know what? We're not going to do all 7 years on this episode. So let's just let everybody know that we are brought to you by Bet Online. It is where the game starts. But guess what? We are not starting. We're ending.
And how do we end?
We end with the poet, Shel Krakowski, the musician, Dave Dresser, and we end by beginning our 7th year of the Baseball and Barbecue podcast with the song Baseball Always Brings You Home.
We'll see you next week for episode number 217.
Bring me a home. baseball.